educated and miseducated and is easily propagandized too. So you could say, well, it's looking kind of grim. Maybe we should think about what people did in Germany. Like, some people left. They got out. And this party is going to end badly. Maybe somewhere else would be more fun. On some days I sympathize with that. Yesterday I was reading a William Burroughs interview from like 1981, and someone, they were talking about, I've heard you want to go to the moon, Mr. Burroughs. And he says, absolutely. If the flying saucer came, I'd go up immediately. I said, well, wouldn't you want to come back? He goes, absolutely not. You know, and sometimes I feel like that, like, get me out of here. But that doesn't seem to be a real alternative. So what gives me hope, or why do we do this magazine? Why do we have these meetings? Why do we keep going on? I think I take a lesson, and I mean, this sounds kind of pretentious, and I don't mean it that way, but I'll just say something. In my understanding is, in the 50s, things were very boring, and things were getting pretty grayed up, and there was a lot of shit going on that people didn't want to deal with, didn't want to talk about. And that's what, and you had, you know, all the housewives on, you know, the early antidepressants and tranquilizers and so forth, and you had the real, obviously it was pre-civil rights, etc. So there's all these horrors going on in the background, and the gradual, the military-industrial complex not winding down from World War II, but somehow finding a new enemy every few years. Korea, Vietnam, then the Cold War, whatever, the Cold War, then Vietnam. So there was all this stuff churning underneath. There was a black, those who were sensitive, those who to stuff were deeply appalled and terrified. And those people were called beatniks. And they felt really alienated. They felt really alone, and I think often they might have felt hopeless too, but they found refuge in the arts, and they found refuge in each other, and they found refuge in hanging out with those who also were downtrodden just because of the color of their skin or because they were poor. And so you had, I mean, imagine the feeling, like, imagine being in the mid-50s and being these, you know, gay, or, well, black, or minority, or gay, or a sensitive poet, or, you know, any of these things, and seeing this go on, and thinking, like, it might just keep going on like this. They didn't know that, like, you know, hippies were going to come in 67. They didn't know. They just thought, like, they couldn't know. I mean, imagine where their minds were at. It must have been terribly depressing. So they hung out with each other. They wrote books, they went to clubs, they listened to music, they found refuge in art, and they found refuge in some in protests and so forth, and they got further and further out there. And they sort of, in my mind, what they did was they incubated a set of ideas of essentially a personal freedom and social justice during this period when those ideas weren't really happening in the mainstream. And then when the time came, they came forth, and they were the ones who fed the people who needed answers, or not answers, but ideas, ways of being, ways of doing, ways of thinking, and so forth. What I mean is, so then the question is, well, why? When do those periods happen? You know, why does a culture suddenly accept all these ideas that have been percolating in the underground? Why does it, if we're aware of them, why don't more people embrace them? Why does it suddenly turn? I don't know if there's a single answer to that. I know V. Vail, who does research books I was talking about earlier, is like really studying this. This is his big life project, is to figure out what the ingredients are for a subculture to like just blow up all of a sudden. And it's an unbelievable project, and it's very fascinating talking with him. But I know that in the 60s what happened, one of the things that happened was this massive demographic shift. The people, you have to think about who if you're age 0 to 80, at what point in your life are you most open to things? And at what point in your life are you most not only open to things but able to enact them? And from the ages like 15 to 25, generally, for most people. So what you look at across history, at least in the, from this is my theory or whatever, is that you look for periods in American history when the portion of the American public that is that age is really high. I mean, like in more ways than one. I mean, you know, when there's basically a lot of kids. And this happened in the 60s because you had all the kids of the World War II, of the baby boomers. They were the baby boomers. There was a boom of babies. They were a whole bunch of babies were born and they came of age. And from in that period, there were so many of them that if you could just get to a certain number of them, you could, if just a certain number of them were open to something, they had the power to start to transform culture. They couldn't completely transform it, but they could start moving some of those ideas that had been percolating before across time, they would be receptive to them, and they could even enact them. Now, so that which brings us to now, which is what's happening right now. I was talking with Robbie about this. Not many people know this, but, or maybe they do know it intuitively or whatever. But what's going on right now is there's the children of the baby boomers are on the way right now. And that whole sector, that of 15 to 25, by around 2010, is going to be a higher percentage of the American overall public than it was in the 60s. All these kids who were born in, say, 1990, between 85 and 95, there's a whole bunch of them, and they're all growing older right now. That's why, you know, it's hard for some. I think most of us here are like Gen X age, you know, which was, if you've ever studied what is Gen X, well, it's a very small generation, like literally, like the absolute number, we're talking like 15 million kids, but this next one is like 40 million, you know, or something like that. I don't have the numbers up on the dry board, but you know, it's huge. And by right around 2010, it becomes like this gigantic number. And this is what gives me hope, because these kids, that's what we're doing. We're trying to incubate a culture to be in place for when those kids come of age. And they're going to come of age having lived for most of their conscious lives. Since they're basically post 9/11 kids, so they will have grown up with the war on terror and the war in Iraq. Will have been going on for years by then, and they're going to be fucking tired of it. And now this might come earlier. Maybe it'll come next year. Maybe it'll come in a couple months. Maybe this thing that's going on in Texas right now with the mother will be a galvanizing thing. I don't know, but I think it's going to be probably a few more years. But that's kind of, to me, that's part of what we're doing with the magazine. Part of why we just keep doing it is because there are a number of artists and thinkers of all ages. Some of them are 20 years old, some of them are 70 years old, some of them are, you know, Joanna Newsom, some of them are John Sinclair, or Brian Eno, or whatever, you know. They're all these different ages, but if we keep spotlighting them, incubating them, helping them along, to whatever degree we can. I don't know how much effect it has, but if we, you know, they're like a growing plant, and we're throwing a little more water there, a little more fertilizer, and they will be there when these kids come up. And, you know, this, if you think about it, this is why, like, you know, in the late 90s, you know, there were all these kid bands, you know, Spice Girls, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, et cetera, et cetera. The reason all those bands were popular, all those music acts were popular, was because there were so many kids at that age who were 9 years old who wanted to listen to music. Those were bands that appealed to 9 year olds. But there were more 9 year olds at that time than there had been in a zillion years. That's why those bands were so big. And now soon those kids are going to be 16 and 20, and they're going to be growing up, you know, hopefully, you know, with bands that blow their minds, you know, Outkast or the White Stripes or Devendra or Comets on Fire or Sleater-Kinney or whatever, and or filmmakers or artists or photographers. And our thing is just to try and keep watering the garden, and hopefully they'll come and play in it. You know, and when they get tired of the adults' antics, which they will be, especially, I mean, it's inevitable. I think it's inevitable. I don't think they're just gonna be like, yeah, it's cool. I'm down with the war on terror. You know. So I think I addressed all the things I said I was gonna do.
Cool. Well, before I open up the question, I just want to ask you to go back to one thing that you stated right at the beginning, which was you made this statement that there are some things that you feel that Arthur or that you were interested in that you feel that you identified, well, maybe we got that started, or maybe we had a little bit part in that. What are those things that you were talking about that you feel culturally that maybe you see going on outside, you know, your publication that you think maybe you had a little bit of?
Yeah. I don't know.
Hand in watering.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have said that. I mean, I can, because it does, do I have proof? Do I have evidence?
Oh, come on.
No.
Don't take credit.
I will say what we've covered, and then you can make up your own mind as to whether it's things that we've consistently covered or whatever, that, and make up your own mind as to whether it's had an impact or not. But we, almost as soon as we started the magazine in 2002, I became aware of a number of artists, music artists, that hadn't existed before we started the magazine. You know, the magazine took like a long time to start. You know, I had this idea, we want to do it free, we want to make a newsprint, we want to distribute it everywhere, we want to have total freedom for the writers, right? You know, and then I was like, but who's going to do the business shit? You know, I don't want to do it, you know, whatever. So it sat there for like a year, and then my partner Lars came and said, great news, I lost my job, let's do your magazine. And then we had another 6 months. And so when we were, all that time, we weren't going, I got to start this magazine in order to cover Devendra Banhart. But once we started the magazine, things just start coming through across your radar. And we just wanted to cover, and we thought, like, that's some right-on stuff. And, like, so we have covered, you know, the so-called avant folk, or whatever you want to call them, musicians and movement, you know, Devendra, Joanna, Newsom, Espers, Josephine Foster, so forth. We've covered them regularly. We have a column written by, it's been in every issue, by Byron Coley and Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth. And they have carte blanche, and they cover music, poetry, film, some prose, and just underground stuff, purely underground. It's very obscure. I mean, when I get the text from them, as I do every 2 months, I just look at it and go, I don't know what the fuck you guys are talking about. I've never heard of any of these people. And they're like, edition of 150, you know, buy them now, but get the lathe cut. And you're just like, what are you, you know? Or this cat's happening down in Australia. And you're like, I don't know. But if you look at them, and I've done this recently, you go back and look at those columns from like the first issues, basically what they covered there very early, we cover later in the front of the mag. You know, like they're just on that stuff. And they're very self-consciously in the tradition of the underground tradition, aesthetic tradition. You know, they cover this, old beat poets who are still happening, because there are a bunch. You know. that are sort of associated, whether it's Charles Potts or some Kenneth Patchen collection that just came out or something, and they keep up with the noise, the jazz dudes that are still going, and the young ones, and they follow the noise, this sort of noise scene that's sort of starting to happen, like sort of getting more attention, you know, whether it's, you know, Wolf Eyes or maybe Lightning Bolt or something. I mean, these are bands that have been going for a while, but they push it out there and push it forward, and now these bands, suddenly Wolf Eyes are on Sub Pop, which is on through Warner Brothers, and people see them and go, oh my God, you know. There's been a whole host of loud, extremely raging, psychedelic rock bands coming up. Comets on Fire, I think, are the best ones, but we've covered them. I have watched them go from playing to 5 people to playing to 400 to playing to, who knows how many now, which is cool, you know. And because they do play an incredible type of music, and it does, you know, do things. I was just playing, before we started wrapping, this CD by this band called Growing, and which is a sort of ambient electronic thing, that a drone